Chapter 8, The Home in Oswego, New York. Printed in the Review and Herald, April 25, 1935. Oswego, New York proved to be a good place from which to publish the present truth. It was more central than Middletown, Connecticut, and there were, not far from Oswego, a number of small companies of Sabbath keepers newly come to the faith that needed counsel and instruction. In those days, there was no church manual, no generally accepted plans for organization among Sabbath keepers. The members had come from many churches, and they were held together by their observance of the seventh day. Yet on many other points of doctrine, they were not in harmony. Therefore, it is not strange that among them were some who were fanatical and contentious. There were disputations and disagreements. These inexperienced believers needed careful instruction and discipline. The forceful testimony of James and Ellen White, correcting false doctrines and rebuking fanaticism, brought peace to the hearts of the humble and teachable ones. Yet in the headstrong and fractious ones, it produced bitterness of soul and opposition. Some of those who were corrected engaged in a warfare of criticism, misrepresentation, and abuse. Here, as in other places where they lived and labored, they were often directed in their movements by visions given to Ellen White in the night. Frequently, upon awakening in the morning, she would specify a nearby company and say, "James, in the night I was bearing testimony to that company. I know that they need help, and we must visit them." Thus prompted, they would go, and when they arrived at the place in which they were directed, they were often greeted with the words, "You have come just at the right time." In one of these companies, which they sometimes visited, where there were contentious elements, they were usually entertained at a home where the husband, though not a Sabbath keeper, was jovial and hospitable, and always welcomed them. His wife was a quiet, consecrated member of the company of believers. One Friday, her husband said to her, "Cook plenty of food for over the Sabbath, for James and Ellen White will probably be here. Your little company of Adventists are frequently in a quarrel, and I have noticed that when the controversy reaches a certain pitch, they come to straighten you out. From what I can see, you need them now, so I advise you to get ready." Sure enough, about the middle of the afternoon, James and Ellen White arrived unannounced and found complete preparations for their entertainment. Numbers 5 and 6 of The Present Truth were printed in the month of December 1849 in Oswego. Like the four numbers printed in Connecticut, they bore the announcement, "Published semi-monthly by James White." But there was a break of several weeks between numbers 6 and 7. Letters from James White, written during this interim, give a picture of a discouraged, disheartened editor. The burden of writing, publishing, circulating, and above all, of financing the enterprise seemed more than he could bear. "I am destitute of means, and am some in debt," he announced to his readers. But he chafed under the necessity of continually begging for the support of the paper. The wearisome correspondence grew heavier and heavier from month to month. The sedentary life, in contrast to his former years of physical activity, was detrimental to his health. Writing to his tried friends, brother and sister Hastings, under date of January 3, 1850, he said, "As for the poor little paper, it has so little sympathy, and I fear so few prayers, that I think it will die. I am in deep trial. The poor scattered sheep who do not see God's servants face to face once a year beg for the paper, but those who are verily glutted with the truth seem to have little or no interest in it. I received a letter from Michigan today, and as I walked and read, I wept to see how they were refreshed with number 5, and, oh my God, what shall I do? I want to work for God, but to publish is an uphill work unless there are many prayers ascending and an interest to sustain a paper. I think I shall hang all up for the present. 6 days later, on the evening of January 9, while praying for their sick babe, Ellen White was given a vision in which she was definitely instructed that the paper should be continued. Relating the vision, she said, "I saw the paper and that it was needed, that souls were hungry for the truth that must be written in the paper. I saw that if the paper stopped for want of means and those hungry sheep died for want of the paper, it would not be James's fault, but it would be the fault of those to whom God had lent his money to be faithful stewards over. I saw that God did not want James to stop yet, but he must write, 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 and speed the message and let it go. I saw that it would go where God's servants cannot go." The following day, January 10, Elder White wrote again to Brother Hastings, relating his experience of discouragement over the publication of the paper, and then of the instruction to continue its publication. He says, "I had been in a hot furnace for some time on account of the burden I felt for the little paper." He speaks of a letter received from one of his brethren who wrote despairingly of the present truth, which hastened his decision, of which he says, "I gave it up forever, but still the burden grew heavier and heavier on me. These texts kept ringing, 'Let your light so shine. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel. Ye are the light of the world,' etc., etc." While he was in this depressed state of mind, the message just referred to regarding the necessity of continuing the present truth had come to Ellen White. This brought him to the decision to continue publishing. He says further in his letter to Brother Hastings, "My way now seems to be made plain, and I hope all my brethren will do their duty and no more nor less. They must go to God and be judges of their own duty." To make it doubly certain to James White and his brethren that the present truth should continue to be published, another vision was given on Sabbath, January 11, in which Ellen White was shown that her husband must write the truth and speed the third angel's message. For several months, Elder White had been gathering material for a little hymn book for the believers in the Advent and the Sabbath, and before resuming the publication of Present Truth, this was arranged and published. As no name had yet been assumed by them, he called his collection Hymns for God's Peculiar People That Keep the Commandments of God and the Faith of Jesus. The poverty of the believers is pathetically indicated in the announcement, "As but a small addition will be wanted, they will come high. Price, 12 for $1, 12.5 cents, single copy." The hymns selected were those applicable to our faith and hope at this time: Holy Sabbath, Second Advent History, The Joys of Eden, The Seal, Fall of Babylon, Adventist's Experience, This World Is Not My Home, I'm a Traveler. Such were the titles of a few of the 53 hymns in the book. These were sung with deep feeling by the little flock, who thus expressed in melody their hopes and experiences. Hear them as they sing of their confidence in God's leading and their determination to press forward. "For Canaan I've started, and on I must go, till all the bright glories of Eden I know. I've made no reserve, and I'm sure I'll not lack, while onward I journey and do not draw back. My soul is enkindled with rapture and love. I fain would ascend to my Jesus above. But nay, I must follow in his humble track and prove my obedience by not drawing back. Then on let us press, for Jesus is near, and strengthen each other with words of good cheer. With zeal ever buoyant and courage near slack, let's be true to our King and never draw back. The hymn book completed and in the hands of the brethren, Elder White resumed the publication of The Present Truth and issued numbers 7 and 8 in March 1850. They were almost entirely devoted to the review of a current editorial article entitled Seventh-day Sabbath Abolished, printed in one of the other Adventist papers. Two more numbers of the paper were printed at Oswego in April and May, respectively. In the May issue, number 10, the last to go forth from Oswego, is a note telling the brethren that they need not expect to receive the present truth for a short time, at least, and they were directed to Otis Nichols of Dorchester, Massachusetts, and Elias Goodwin of Oswego, New York, as agents from whom might be secured, without money or price, back numbers of the paper, as well as a few tracts that had been issued. It was stated that the paper was suspended for a time, that the companies of brethren in Vermont and Canada might again be visited. While making this trip, their child Edson was left in the care of Sister Clarissa Bonfoy. In these days, when our ministers visit among well-organized churches, they usually find a hearty welcome and unity in belief and practice among the believers. Such can little appreciate how different were the conditions that met these pioneers in the days before organization was effected. Of their experiences on this tour, Mrs. White says, "We labored very hard, suffering many privations to accomplish but little. We found the brethren and sisters in a scattered and confused state. Almost everyone was affected by some error, and all seemed zealous for their own opinions. We often suffered intense anguish of mind in meeting with so few who were ready to listen to Bible truth, while they eagerly cherished error and fanaticism. Often the methods of travel were wearisome and painful. In order to meet one appointment at Sutton, Vermont, it was necessary to travel 40 miles by stage over the hilly, rough, and dusty roads. As fresh relays of horses were provided every 10 miles, Mrs. White availed herself of the privilege of resting for 10 minutes at a hotel, for she was very weak. Some of the brethren who attended this meeting at Sutton were warm-hearted and generous, and anxious to see the message go. They decided that Elder and Mrs. White should have a conveyance of their own, so they made up a purse of $175 with which to purchase a horse and a carriage. Then it was arranged for some of the brethren who had horses for sale to bring them to a certain place on a Monday morning that Elder and Mrs. White might make their selection. During the night preceding the day when the horse was to be selected, Ellen White was given a vision in which she saw a company of about 20 men assembled at the crossroads and three horses brought forward for inspection. The first was a high-spirited sorrel, rather nervous. As they were observing his movements, the angel that was acting as her guide said to her, "Not that one." Next, there was brought forward a large gray horse, clumsy-footed and rather awkward. Again, her guide said, "Not that one." The third was a large, beautiful, dapple chestnut. He had an intelligent face, an arched neck, and was sway-backed. As this horse was led forward, her guide said, "That is the one for you." The fulfillment of the vision was complete and exact. When they arrived at the place designated for the selection of a horse, they met the very company that had been shown to Ellen White in vision the preceding night. Three horses were brought forward for inspection exactly as presented to her, the nervous sorrel, the clumsy gray, and then old Charlie, the big dapple chestnut. The selection was quickly made, and horse, harness, and covered buggy were given to Elder White. Of their first journey to Canada East, known today as Quebec, with their own horse and carriage, Ellen White wrote, "My throat troubled me much, and I could not speak aloud or even whisper without suffering. We rode, praying as we went, for strength to endure the journey. About every 10 miles, we were obliged to stop that I might rest. My husband braided the tall grass and tied the horse to it, giving him a chance to feed, then spread my cloak upon the grass for a resting place for me. Thus we continued until we arrived at Melbourne. The trips made with horse and buggy were among the most enjoyable and restful experiences in the life of these careworn and overworked ambassadors. Their first horse was a source of many pleasant memories. Old Charlie was very fond of apples. Sometimes, when they were driving in the autumn where orchards lined the roads and big, ripe apples lay in the path of the travelers, Elder White loosened the check rein and left the horse free to show what he would do. And Charlie appreciated his privileges. When approaching an apple tree with apples on the ground, he would gently slow down from a 7-mile pace, select a good apple within easy reach, pick it up, and then throw his head high and dash on at full speed, eating the apple as he journeyed. Old Charlie never knew how much his master suffered later on from criticism because he drove so good a horse. Returning to Vermont, Elder and Mrs. White filled an appointment at Johnson. Here they found a goodly number of brethren and sisters assembled, and here the battle with rank fanaticism was renewed. Certain men had imposed upon the company, and with their high pretensions and determination to be leaders, had cast a fear over some who were conscientious and fearful of offending God. At the opening meeting, Libby and Bailey, two of those who for a long time had deceived and oppressed the brethren, came into the meeting accompanied by two women, not their wives, who were dressed in white linen, which was to represent the righteousness of the saints, with their long black hair hanging loose about their shoulders. Regarding what followed, Mrs. White wrote, "I had a message for them, and while I was speaking, Libby kept his black eyes fastened upon me, but I had no fear of his influence. Strength was given me from heaven to rise above their satanic power. The children of God who had been held in bondage began to breathe free and rejoice in the Lord." As our meeting progressed, these fanatics sought to rise and speak, but they could not find opportunity. But as prayer was being offered at the close of the meeting, Bailey came to the door and commenced speaking. The door was closed upon him. He opened it and again began to speak. "The power of God fell upon my husband, and the color left his face as he arose from his knees and laid his hand upon Bailey, exclaiming, 'The Lord does not want your testimony here. The Lord does not want you here to distract and crush his people.' The power of God filled the room, and Bailey commenced to fall backward against the house. The power of God in the house was painful to that fanatical party. Bailey looked terrified. He staggered and came near falling to the floor. The place was awful on account of the presence of the Lord. All that company of darkness left the place, and the sweet Spirit of the Lord rested upon his dear tried children. The cause of God in Vermont had been cursed by fanatical spirits, but at this meeting these wicked persons received a check from which they never recovered." In this remarkable experience, we see clearly the manifestation of God's goodness in sending messages of instruction to his people, which saved them from fanaticism.